today's show is proudly sponsored by Minding the Gap. You guys all know that mental health for dancers matters. You're on board. You want to see the culture in your studio change, but where do you start? Enter Minding the Gap. Minding the Gap is dedicated to seeing mental health regarded with the same seriousness as physical health in dance culture, and they come armed with solutions. Whether it's helping you craft policies and procedures that protect the mental wellness of dancers and staff, consulting to build a robust mental health program in your school or company, or providing mental health skills workshops for your students and teachers, Minding the Gap has you covered. They bring the expertise of the best dance mental health experts in the world to you. For more information, visit www.wearemindingthegap.org or click the link in the show notes. Hello, dancers. Welcome back. Today, I spoke with Nina Puckett of Erase the Stigma Through Dance. Nina very bravely shares her journey with mental health and how that journey has inspired a platform for mental health advocacy. Just as a heads up, you will hear a few bleeps in the conversation. These are present simply to delete specific medication names mentioned on the show and are there for health and safety purposes. Nina is a dancer, choreographer, licensed massage therapist, business owner, and mental health advocate. She has her BFA in dance from UNCG and also studied at the Theatre Academy of Finland and the Western Australia Academy of Performing Arts. She's a certified movement analyst from the Laban Institute of Movement Studies and founded Erase in 2020. This is a really, really fun conversation because Nina has taken some events that have happened in her life that, I mean, quite honestly, it could have gone the other way. But she's taken the adversity that she's experienced and turned it into something truly beautiful from, like I said, a platform for mental health advocacy to community outreach in dance. Please remember that I am not a mental health professional and anything you hear me say on the show is based on my personal experience and perspectives and should not be considered medical advice. By listening to this podcast, you agree not to use any of the content to diagnose you or anyone else of any mental or health condition. If any of the things shared on the show resonate with you, I encourage you to talk to your doctor or click the link in the show notes to find the best healthcare professional for you. And before we get started, I also want to mention that anything said on the podcast reflects my dance experience as a whole and not any one teacher, studio, or company. The opinions shared by my guests in this episode are their own and come from their individual viewpoint. This conversation was super fun with Nina, and I cannot wait to share it with you. So here you go. Hello, dancers. Welcome back. Today, I'm really excited to have on Nina Puckett. Welcome, Nina.
Thank you.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm so excited to hear everything about your organization and what you're doing for the dance world and all the good things. So let's go ahead and dive in. I'd love to hear a brief overview of your relationship with ballet. And if it's relevant and you feel comfortable, what role your mental health has played throughout your dancing career, and of course, how you became a mental health advocate in the dance space.
Sure. So I'll try to make it sort of succinct. So I actually grew up in New Jersey dancing at a small dance studio with my sister, and we always did duets and very, very close. And then I went on to college to study dance at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. So I got my BFA there. I spent two semesters abroad. One semester was in Australia at the Western Australia Academy of Performing Arts, which was a conservatory. So it was slightly different from the university.
Yeah, that's so
and
cool.
Then I went to Helsinki, Finland at a place called Teatteri Korkeakoulu, which is the Theater Academy of Finland. So then I moved back, finished my school, got my BFA, and then moved to New York and went to the Laban Bartynieff Institute of Movement Studies and became a certified movement analyst. And then from there, I met my husband, and I was also going to massage school, so I finished massage school. And then I met my husband and moved to Oklahoma. So here I studied and danced with a company called Oklahoma Movement, who I still kind of help co-direct. and perform with them. Mental health has played a huge role for me. Growing up in the dance studio, I had a lot of anxiety, and it kind of started in the studio, and then it kind of morphed its way into every aspect of my life. And I'm not sure what it was about the studio, but I feel like it wasn't the teachers. I feel like it was a lot of like looking at yourself in the mirror and being hyper aware of what you're doing and feeling like you're being looked at and judged by others, even though we had a really wonderful upbringing. Our studio was amazing and everybody was so close, but I would get really, really anxious. Yeah. And in college, it got really, really bad. And so I had to go on some medication, which actually ended up helping a lot. I actually went on medication and got stabilized about 3 weeks before I left for Australia. So oh, wow.
Good timing.
So it was really good timing. Yeah. So yeah, but
that's
in
huge.
So I always kind of struggled with panic attacks and general anxiety and a lot of social anxiety. Like I'd get really hot. Sometimes I would break out in hives. And so it would just be really embarrassing. And I could never really understand what was going on. I just thought that I was just like a nervous person. But I did do 4 years of cognitive behavioral therapy when I lived in New York. And that helped me a lot because I realized that I always thought that everybody was judging me. And I think it started in the studio just from like having people watch you dance. And then it just morphed its way into every aspect of my life. Like if I was writing a check or if I was being asked to speak in massage school or being looked at, I would just feel like it was that people were judging me. And I learned that they were not judging me. They were just looking at me.
Yeah.
And maybe they were judging me.
Using their senses.
Yeah. Right. Maybe they were judging me. But if they were, like, that's not really my problem. You know what I mean? And I think as you get older, you don't really worry so much about what others think. I think that, you know, the more you age, the things that you worried about when you were younger, like if you had a pimple or if your face gets kind of funny red or whatever, you get nervous and upset when you're a teenager. But I think when you're older, you just don't really worry about that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
anymore.
You just don't care.
Yeah. Yeah, you just really don't care because life is like you're just trying to like make money and like pay your bills and feed your family and be a good person and go after your dreams. Mm-hmm. But in 2013, I had a very bad mental breakdown and I ended up with a condition called schizoaffective disorder. So I was actually weaning down on my and I started getting hallucinations and I couldn't get into the doctor that was prescribing it, which was just a regular general practitioner. And I ended up in the ER and they told me, oh, you need to come off the because they couldn't figure out anything, any other reason why I would be having hallucinations.
Yeah.
So I came off the and within 3 days I was in motion, like couldn't stop moving. And
oh,
I started, oh my gosh, it was terrible. I was hallucinating. So I wasn't seeing figures, but I was seeing smoke come out of things. And then I would also hear things very, very loudly. Like it would seem like I had sensory overload and it was just my brain chemistry was really off. So I ended up going to a psychiatric ward for like 3 days and they wanted me to go back on the Paxil, which is what I should have done. But I was so far gone with delusions and feeling like it was poison.
Yeah,
that
especially
I didn't...
since the doctor told you like this is what's causing your problems.
Right.
Yeah.
So, which now that I look back, yeah, it's crazy. And now that I look back, it's because I was weaning off and it's an SSRI and you need to wean off slowly. And even my small jump, I had had reactions to. And so the last thing I should have done would have been to come off of it. I should have maybe gone up a little bit and gone down slower. So I ended up going home to New Jersey and staying with my parents for about 6 months. And got stabilized with my doctor there, my family psychiatrist. I had schizoaffective, which is hallucinations and delusions.
Wow.
And I had to go on like 5 medications to get stabilized. It took me 6 months to get stabilized. So I was home in New Jersey. It was really bad. I gained like 75 pounds because those medications make you very, very, very hungry. So I had to learn to sort of move in a new body. Like when I moved back down, and I really needed to have like 24-hour supervision.
You needed that support.
I really needed that support. And my family, we're very close. So I just treasure the fact that I still have them. And, you know, when I got back, I have a support network here too. Of course, Craig, my husband now, and my mother-in-law and my sister-in-law and brother-in-law. So lots of friends and family here. So I was dancing, and in Oklahoma Movement, we decided to create a dance based on my mental illness, like an evening length. And as I was doing that, I realized that I wanted to really just dive into mental health and dance. And so out of this show, I decided to create an organization, a separate organization called Erase the Stigma Through Dance, where the focus was, it's not a dance company, but it's a platform. So a place where there's social media, blogs, we have an annual symposium where we'll have like keynote speakers who will speak on the mind and body connection, and some mental health professionals, and then a movement class and a culminating performance by Oklahoma Movement, which for the first symposium, we're going to be doing the show that we did with Oklahoma Movement. So we're basically just hiring Oklahoma Movement to come and perform that show that we did last year that kind of started all of this. But I actually had two clients that I was talking to about, two massage clients that I was talking to about my ideas of having this platform and this nonprofit. And so they're on my board. So they helped kind of facilitate and helped kind of gear, you know, what this was going to be. Cause I knew I didn't want it to be a dance company, but I knew I wanted dance to be a part of it. So I wanted to just sort of connect the two. We have these classes that we haven't started yet, but we have like a whole curriculum of classes where we're going to be going to different locations and different facilities and teaching movement classes to help with mental health. And then having some resources afterwards, like a sheet of resources that I've compiled of local and national resources, like psychiatric wards, you know, hospitals, licensed professional counselors.
Oh, that's so cool.
24-hour
lines. Yeah. Oh, I love this so much. So a couple of things. Going back,
I don't know if I even answered any of your questions.
No, you absolutely did. Yes, you did, for sure. No, that was that was a beautiful story. And first of all, thank you so much for being so open and willing to share that, because that's a really powerful story. And I just, you know, I'm really grateful that you shared that with me. I feel like, too, this is a good place to kind of say that, you know, if you are pursuing medication to help with your mental health, it is important, if you can, to try to get with a psychiatrist rather than your GP.
Absolutely. absolutely.
And maybe also get some talk therapy as well with either a counselor, therapist, you know, whatever, you know, you have access to. But yeah, there's so many people that are, you know, who are wanting to take care of themselves and care for their mental health, and the drugs certainly can be a big part of that. But I think a lot of people obtain them, I know I have in the past, through their general practitioner, which it's like, I don't know. I mean,
I feel like the psychiatric medications, I feel like general practitioners know about them, but psychiatrists really, really understand these medications so much better. And so it's like, they can prescribe it for anxiety. But really, if you're taking a psychiatric medication, I do think now that I look back, I should have been seeing a psychiatrist, because also with psychiatrists, I know my psychiatrist now, she's amazing. And if I'm having like a crisis, or even if I like feel a little funny one day, I've called her multiple times just saying, I'm feeling a little bit funny. We just upped my medication, or we just lowered the medication. And so I get immediate response, because there's a nurse there that even if she's in appointments, the nurse can talk to the doctor and get back to me within the same day and say, okay, listen, we called you in your script. We want you to go up a little bit, or we want you to go back to your level, or just stay put, or, you know, she can always get me in on an emergency basis. So, and then of course there's the 24-hour emergency places, and psychiatric wards, but let me tell you, those beds are full. They are full. I had a friend that was that was really going through a crisis, a lot of psychosis, and she was not able to get into any psychiatric facilities because the beds are just full. And so if you really need care, sometimes, you know, if you're even take medication just for anxiety. You never know if it's going to develop into something
that's more serious. Or, you know, you want to make sure, too, that if you're on other medications that are unrelated to your mental health, you want to make sure that all the levels are fine. And, so I think it's just, you know, a great time to say for everyone out there, like, if you are pursuing that route for your mental health, that's wonderful, and hopefully it works out for you. But if you can, please, please try to seek out a psychiatrist to help you manage those medications.
And I think there's such a stigma towards psychiatrists. You know, people don't want to go to see a psychiatrist because they think, oh, people are going to think I'm crazy. But it's like, you're not crazy. You know, it's just a doctor that focuses on the brain. And so it's just like, if you have a broken arm, you're not going to go to your general practitioner and be like, oh, I broke my arm. I mean, you're going to probably go to a hospital.
Or if you're a dancer and you have an orthopedic injury, you're going to go see an ortho and a PT, not your GP.
Yeah, exactly.
No, that's cool. So, and then the other thing too was just really, really interested and excited to hear about this organization and how it's changing things and what it's doing for your community. So I'm just going to share with the listeners a little snippet from your website. Guys, the organization is Erase the Stigma Through Dance. And the quote is, changing perceptions of mental illness through advocacy, education, and the art of dance. So, that's a beautiful, beautiful statement. I'd love to hear about the origin. So you said you started in 2020, like kind of what that looked like, especially in the middle of the pandemic.
Yeah.
And how you're striving to achieve that mission in your community.
Yeah. So actually the quote on there is kind of like our tagline. And then we also have like a fuller mission statement. And I can tell you what that is. That is to engage communities in mental health awareness by fusing mental health advocacy and education with the art of dance through events, classes, and yearly symposiums. So it's quite a long mission statement. But in 2020, so we really, up until this point, we've really just been existing on social media and through our blogs. We've had a couple of blog posts about some other dancers in the community that have made works based on mental illness. We had a little on social media, I did a call to choreographers or dancers who wanted to respond to the idea of containment during the pandemic. And so I got some videos that are on, we have a highlight on our Instagram page called Containment, and it's just dancers from all over creating improvisation based on the idea of feeling contained, you know, in their body and in their space, because they're being contained from having to be home and not able to get out anywhere. So really, and our classes, we wanted to spend a lot of time figuring out. We've had a number of board meetings figuring out exactly what we want this organization to do. And so we've done a lot of groundwork. So we haven't had our first event yet, which our first event is going to be our first annual symposium, November 4th. And that's going to be at the Tulsa Ballet. But up until now, we've just been existing on social media. I've done a couple of interviews with Catherine Boland. She did an interview for her YouTube series on social justice and dance called Move for a Movement. And then Sephora, who's a licensed professional social worker who's on our board, and Debbie Smith Berlin, who's also on our board. We did another interview with her, with Catherine Boland, for DIY Dancer, like an online publication. So that's been really fun just to kind of get the word out. And then I was actually invited by the National Delaware Dance Education Organization to do, they had like an event called Solos at Home. And so there was a number of students. So I was able to share my story and a little bit about the organization. But I think just sharing my story and kind of being on social media and putting out quotes and ideas and thoughts to help just sort of erase the stigma, you know, and I think that's why I like to do these talks, is because I feel like the more we talk about it, you know, the less sort of weird it seems. And I found that when I first started telling people about what was happening, what had happened to me, because you know, I had a massage business at the time. So when I came back from my six month leave, I had to tell my clients what was going on. You know, they all thought I had cancer or they weren't sure. And so the first person I told, I was very nervous to tell. And the response I got was not like, oh, wow, that's so weird. Or they said, oh my gosh, that's so interesting. I've never heard that you could think that the government is after you or that birds are following you. And I said, I completely understand. Cause I mean, I thought the television was talking to me and the radio was talking to me. I mean, it is just the weirdest thing. And it's so scary, but it's, again, it's just brain chemistry. It's just a distortion of reality, and it's not your fault. And I felt so embarrassed, and I felt like it was my fault. You know what? I went down on the medication and I should have been seeing a psychiatrist. And it's like, no, I followed the doctor's orders and directions, and this is what happened. And, you know, going back to what you said about, if you're on a medication, psychiatric medication, and they prescribe you something that interacts, that actually happened to me. I was prescribed after I was stabilized. I was able to come down on most of my medications and lose like the 75 pounds. And then I ended up getting like a sinus infection. And so I went to the urgent care and they saw the medications I was on in my history. And they put me on 3 steroids and I had a relapse. And when I went back to my psychiatrist, she said they should have never put you on steroids, because anybody with a history of psychosis, if they put you on any kind of steroid, that can trigger your symptoms to come back. So with me, it's always been very medication induced. Whenever I've had about 2 relapses, and it's always been, the first time was after the steroids and the second time was after a specific antibiotic. So it's always been medication, but you know, life changes. Sure. And I think your environment plays a part, stress plays a part, you know, but for me, thankfully, it seems like most of my stuff can be balanced with medication. And I just stay on my medication. Now I take Paxil and I take Rexulti, which is an antipsychotic. So that helps with my sort of lingering effects I had from just what I went through, is just a lot of dissociation. And the Rexulti helps so much with the dissociation. And that's just a coping mechanism. So talk therapy is always good for that. I haven't been seeing a therapist actually, because I always say that my mother-in-law is my therapist, but I just use the tools that I learned in therapy. And if I feel like it's getting out of control, I will be one to go and seek
therapy. That's a good point too, because a lot of people I think might be hesitant to seek out a mental health professional because they think, oh, well, if I go now, I'm going to have to go the rest of my life. And that's not true at all.
Right. Correct.
Yeah, it could be a season of your life. I have a friend who, her and her husband go to a marriage counselor twice a year. Like a checkup.
Yeah,
it's like
that's
a physical
good.
Checkup of their marriage. Yeah, you like know? A checkup. Like it can look so different to so many people, just depending on what your needs are and what you're going through. You know, I've taken breaks from my therapist, you know, 6 months here, a year there. Sometimes shorter, it just kind of depends on your life and what's going on. So yeah, it's a really good example.
Right, exactly.
I'm curious to dig a little bit more into the organization. So what dance spaces do you serve? Are there any specific age groups or a cohort that's your main focus, or are you kind of just open to whoever needs your services?
I think we are definitely open to whoever needs our services. I'm very interested in a couple of different areas. Like, I would love to go into a mental health facility, like a mental health psychiatric ward, and offer classes there. So I want to do that. Or maybe women prisons, you know, people that are in addiction recovery. We talked a little bit about also doing like after school programs for children. So I think, like, for me, my expertise is definitely more in adults. I don't have a lot of experience teaching young children. So we would probably have teachers that have more experience, you know, working with children with dance and movement. But we're kind of open to really, we're kind of just sort of figuring out right now what cohorts we want to work with. But those are definitely 3 that I'm very interested in. I would love to go to a psychiatric ward for people that are inpatient, because let me tell you, when you are there, there is nothing to do. And you end up, you know, they have therapy maybe one hour out of the week, and there's no sort of somatic therapy. There's no sort of movement that they're doing. And I think the way back into the mind is through the body. I read that quote by Erica Thornhill, I think. Oh, I forget her name, but somebody that I follow on social media, and she said that the way into the mind is through the body. And I feel like that's so true. Like, there's so little somatic movement that we, and therapy that we think about, you know, everything is all about talk therapy. And I'm so glad that there's dance therapists out there for people that need therapy that aren't responding to talk therapy, you know, but movement and getting back into your body.
Yeah, and we hold a lot in our bodies too. And, you know, that as massage therapists, we both know that sometimes those things, they just have to come out. And whether that's through manual therapy or through movement, those are great ways. Those interactions with your body is a wonderful way to help to release things that you might be holding physically in your muscles and in your body. And yeah, I love too the idea of going into prisons. I'll have to connect you with my friend Sarah Gonzalez. I had her on the show a couple of weeks ago, and she works with Cachette Dance in, I believe it's in Albuquerque, but they have an educational dance program that goes into, I think it's a women's prison.
I'll have to
double check that. But yeah, they have an inmate program where they have dance classes for inmates, and it's really powerful. So
yeah, that's so cool.
Yeah, that's really great. You're the second person I've met now who's had this idea. I think it's so great.
Yeah.
It can be really powerful for people in those populations for sure.
Yeah.
So, you know, looking at those different cohorts and different things, I mean, so do you have an idea of like having different types of speakers for different age groups or different people of different walks of life? Tell me a little bit about those programs that you're developing.
So for the REACH program, which is the classes that we haven't started yet, which we're just kind of getting everything ready for, I'd imagine we'd probably want to bring in a speaker, you know, before the class, just to kind of like have a mental health professional there. But our speakers are really going to be more at our symposium. So kind of the overview of our symposium is there's going to be a performance, two performances by some local dance artists and international dance artists. And then there's going to be a keynote speech, which will be about 30 minutes on the mind-body connection, and then a somatic movement class. And then we'll have like breakout sessions. So whoever doesn't want to take the movement class can listen to two mental health speakers. And then after that, there'll be a culminating performance by Oklahoma Movement, which is going to be that piece that's going to be, which is about my story and also an author. For the show was called Between Us to Rewind. And it was my story and also a friend of mine. He's an author. His name is Francesco Granieri, and he wrote a book called Pavarotti and Pancakes. And it's all about his mom, him growing up with his mom, who had multiple personality disorder, which is now called dissociative identity disorder. But he's a friend of my husband's and a friend of mine. And so we wanted to sort of compare and contrast his story with his family being a family member of somebody that had mental illness and my story. And so we put those two family stories together to make our piece, which was about 2 hours. So we're only going to show about 45 minutes of it, kind of the main sections for the symposium. So but Francesco's book is amazing. I mean, he's so raw and so honest, and he's such a good person. Like, just knowing him as a person and seeing what he went through. I feel like, and my, you know, my dad read his book twice, and my dad's dying to meet him because my dad and him are so similar in that they were both trying to figure out how to help somebody with a mental illness when they don't feel like anything is wrong with them. Because I never felt like there was something wrong with me. I felt like nobody else was believing me, that, you know, the TV was talking to me, and I felt so alone. And I felt like, why aren't my parents believing me that this stuff is going to happen to them? You know, like all this bad stuff is going to happen to everybody. And like, you know, it's just a different state of reality, you know?
Well, right. I was just going to use that word when you're living in this reality that, I mean, that's probably a worse nightmare, is that you're trying to tell people the truth, and you are telling the truth.
You are telling the truth.
That's what
your
brain is telling you, what's real.
Exactly. And so what's interesting is that they say, I've heard mental health professionals say that when somebody comes in and they say, like, you know, the birds are talking to you or whatever, the psychiatrist will usually say things like, well, what are the birds telling you? They're not saying things like, no, the birds aren't telling you, because the psychiatrist understands that for you, that's your reality. And so they're trying to dig a little bit deeper into why it is that you think that they're following you. You know, like, what is it about the birds that makes you think that they're following you? And Dr. Nielsen, you know, my first psychiatrist, he passed away, and I was doing phone sessions with him in Oklahoma, and I was devastated. But I remember he picked up on the fact that his phone rang, and my movement kind of changed. And I think he picked up on the fact that obviously I thought that was some sort of sign, and there's a thing called ideas of reference, where you think things in the universe are signs for you. And I had that, but I didn't know it's actually called something. But it's an actual condition of psychosis where you think that things are signs for you. Like if you see a sign on the road and it says, you know, Tulsa, 20 miles that way, you know, I'd think, well, I work in Tulsa, even though I live in Broken Arrow, I work in Tulsa, and it's telling me to go that way. You know what I mean? Like it's, you know, and then you're in such a heightened state of sensory, that you just remember everything from that time. Like people think like, how do you remember all that? I'm like, how could I not remember that? Right. How could I not remember that? You know, it was so amazing. Like, I was so fearful, you know, that I just remember such minute details. I mean, I can't even remember what I ate for dinner last night, and I remember all that. You know what I mean?
You know, I think the story is really interesting. It's certainly really unique in that you don't often get to speak to someone who's experienced these things. And so I think it's fascinating. But also, you know, we're talking about your sense of reality and so forth, and people believing or not believing you. You know, I think we can even take that down into a more basic scale of someone who just has basic anxiety or who's someone who has clinical depression.
Correct.
It's impossible to explain to someone who does not experience those things what they are like and how they affect you day to day.
Like,
it's just not possible. You know, for example, if you're depressed clinically and that's manifesting in the fact that you literally cannot get out of bed for days, you can't shower, you can't feed yourself, you can't do these things. And to the outside world of people who've never experienced that, they might say, oh, well, she's just lazy.
Or
she's like just snap out of it. And that's where all of these sentiments come from, is just people cannot understand that this is your reality. You physically cannot get out of bed, or you physically can't take ballet class without sweating profusely, with your palms sweating, your face turning red, and you know, whatever your manifestation is. I think your story is really interesting because it magnifies that and really emphasizes the fact that everyone is living their own reality, and especially those with any type of mental health challenges, it's just magnified.
Yeah, it's so true. I mean, I remember with schizoaffective, you have hallucinations and delusions, and then there's also a mood disorder with it. So that's what differentiates it from schizophrenia. So with mine, I had sort of a second wave, which was clinical depression. So it was like major depression. And I just would cry all day for hours. And this was when I was at home in New Jersey, and I also like had a really hard time getting up in the morning, and my mom would just like make me get up, and I'd be like, there's nothing I'm even going to do today. Like, you know, and I would just cry and cry and cry. And it was just, I would call it a chemical cry, but I would never want to be back there again. It is just the worst. I don't know what was worse, the crying or the psychosis. I mean, I would say the psychosis was definitely worse for me. But you're right. Until you experience it yourself, it's really hard because, you know, my husband is very stable. He's very like practical, very stable, you know, and you know, he's so good for me, I feel like, to be in a relationship with, because he really has, I think at the beginning, he probably was like, what is going on? Because they don't have mental illness in their family, you know? And he used to help me by just saying like, well, what is the problem? And how can you fix it? Let's freeze it. You know, he's very good when I'm having anxiety, because he's zoom out. Let's freeze it. Let's zoom out. You know, he's very practical. But when you're going through it, you know, you're thinking all these crazy thoughts, and it's so hard to explain to other people what anxiety is like unless they experience it too.
You know? It's impossible nearly.
Yeah.
I mean, you can explain your physical symptoms if you have them.
Right.
But yeah, it's really wild, isn't it?
Yeah, and the emotional. And, you know, for some people, it's I think that there's definitely some people that have a chemical imbalance, and that it's just their brain chemistry, or it's genetic. Mm-hmm. And so they have a tendency towards that. And I think for other people, maybe it's more situational or traumatic events. Mm-hmm. You know, definitely. Mm-hmm. I think in my case, it was a little bit of both. But you know, I think figuring out what the root of the problem is for you and for person A and person B, they may have the same exact illness, like panic disorder, but one person, it's from a traumatic event and they have heart palpitations. And then another person, it's maybe more genetic, and or because they don't exercise enough or they don't get enough movement in their life, and their manifestation is just extreme sweating. You know, it's so interesting how our bodies are so different. And so that's why there is no sort of one medication that fits all. And that for most people, it's sort of a cocktail of medications. I mean, for me, it took six months to get a cocktail of five of them. And then eventually I was able to wean off of all of them.
Well, and sometimes too, that recipe can be, it could include medication, but it could also include meditation. It can include movement. It can include self-care. It can include, you know, talk therapy, you know, all like, there's so many different avenues that people can go down to discover what works best for them. And like you said, there's no one solution for even two people with the same mental health concern.
Yeah, because I know, like, for some people, like, I know people that like to run. Not everybody that likes to run is like this, but a lot of people that like to run, I've met so many runners that say, I actually run because it's my antidepressant.
Yeah.
You know, and I run because it helps me clear my mind. It helps me, you know, for self-care. And, you know, I have a number of things that I do for self-care. Like, I try to get a massage once a month, and I go for reflexology once a month. And I've completely changed how I eat. Like, I try not to eat too much sugar, although I do like my Dunkin' Donuts coffee, but, with the
You're a true Jersey girl.
A true Jersey girl. Everybody sees me with my coffee. I have it right here, and I do the caramel swirl. So I know I shouldn't do that, but I try to keep that to a minimum. But changing my diet has helped too, because if I have too much sugar, that makes me really anxious, or too much caffeine. You know, I remember one time I had the Charlie Cold Foam over at Dunkin' Donuts, and Craig and I both had it, and I was making scrubs, and I remember I was like shaking as I was like trying to pour the essential oils, and he's like, are you okay? He's like, yeah, I'm feeling a little jittery too. I'm like, yeah, I think it was that Charlie Cold Foam.
Yeah, my eyeballs are shaking. It's fine.
But it was interesting that like it was like just caffeine that brought on some anxiety. So sometimes it's things that you're eating or – you know, that you don't realize. And of course, we all wish that it was like, oh, well, if I just stop eating this, then I won't get anxiety. And it's just a part of it that can help, you know, part of it that can help you.
Exactly.
But that's one thing I try to do on social media, is like put out like good quotes. You know, I'm going to start doing some positive affirmations. I listened to a talk with Terry Hyde, who has the
Counseling for Dancers. I've had him on the show twice, actually.
Oh, really?
He's a friend of the show.
I love him. Yeah, I don't know him personally, but I'm very active on his page, and he did a talk with Austin Crumley, and he talked a lot about like meditation, because he was a Reiki practitioner, you know, and he talks a lot about like meditation and affirmation. So that was one thing I wanted to start doing more on social media, was I did an affirmation last week, posted an affirmation, but affirmations are so powerful. And I loved what he said about how affirmations can be positive or negative. You know, like you can give yourself a negative affirmation. Like,
we are all so good at those negative affirmations, aren't we?
Yes. I mean, but I also think to myself, how creative are people with anxiety? We're so creative, because We can literally think ourselves in and make think ourselves into a panic attack, like think our way into it just with our mind.
Oh, yeah.
And so if we can think our way into it, can't we think our way out of it? And can't we think our way into like calm and peace in our body? And so it's like,
yeah,
I always think that people with mental health are so interesting and just highly creative. Because we're able to do that to ourselves.
Right.
It's almost like a skill. You know what I mean? A learned skill.
It's the anti-superpower.
Yeah, it's the anti-superpower. So.
So I just want to talk a little bit more before I let you go about the symposium.
Yeah.
So you've talked about the different components of it and that sort of thing. But I'd love to hear what your goals are for that symposium.
Yeah, so the goal is definitely to get the conversation going and get people open to the idea of talking about mental health. And I'm going to be one of the speakers in the beginning, and I'm going to share a little bit of my story. I know my dad is going to be one of the speakers.
Aww.
And the goal of that too, with him speaking, is to get people to understand how to help somebody that's having a mental illness. You know, what you can do, what things, not what things to say and what not to say, but what's helpful and what's maybe not helpful. And then also a goal is to just get the community into the idea that movement can help with mental health through the class that we offer and then through the speeches. And then obviously get people to appreciate dance a little bit more is definitely one of the goals.
Absolutely.
But I would say definitely to erase the stigma, to help get the conversation going and make people feel like it's normal and it's okay to talk about these things. So I feel like the more people I tell my story to, you know, the more of a difference I'm making. And I really feel like this organization or this platform is kind of my life mission. You know, I feel like it's really what I was meant to do in this world. I felt that way with dance. You know, I felt like, oh, I'm supposed to be a dancer. And then I felt that way with massage. Oh, I'm supposed to help heal people through massage. But now I'm like, I think putting everything together of what I've gone through in my life and just my experiences and kind of what my talents are, you know, I feel like I want to just combine all those tragedies and those successes and combine all of me into this organization that helps others and can reach others. And I'd love to see some other dance companies kind of talking about mental health. And I think it's I think it's kind of coming at the perfect time because of the pandemic. And so I think mental health is now being taken more seriously. And I love the counseling for dancers. I mean, speaking about cohorts again, I'd love to go into universities, maybe through dance programs, and offer some movement classes, you know, not only to the dance program students, but to the whole, all of the university, because often anxiety presents itself in high school and we all know in college, you know.
Yes. Yeah, for sure. For sure. That can be a really, I mean, it's a formative time, right? It's where, you know, you do a lot of your identity building as a teenager, but when you go to college, it's where you really test out that identity.
Yeah, you're trying to figure out what you want to do, who you want to be, and it's just so hard, and there's so many stressors in classes, and if you're a dance major, you know, it's like, not only do you have, if you're at a university, it's like, not only do you have the stresses of all the dance classes and all the rehearsals, and then you also have your regular, you know, curriculum with your English and your health and your science, and you have, you know, your papers, and then you want to have a social life, you know, and meet friends and, you know, good have luck. Experiences. It's like, good luck with all that, you know, good luck trying to make it all happen. And we know as dancers, we want to make it all happen. You know, we want to do everything, you know.
For sure. For sure. Yeah. That's really cool though. I'm excited for you and excited to hear more about Erase Through Dance and what it's doing in the community. It's really cool. So, before I let you go, I want to do like a couple of two sort of lighter, funner, that's not a word.
That's okay. I know questions. What you mean.
Yeah. So the first one, and I ask these of all of my guests, and I get some really fun answers. So the first one is, I'm going to put you in my time machine.
Okay.
And I'm going to send you back to 14-year-old Nina.
Okay.
And have you speak to yourself.
Okay.
14-year-old Nina, what would you say to yourself as a young dancer?
Well, first I will just say that at 14 was actually the time that I started having the anxiety problems. That's when it all started. So I would say definitely to just believe in yourself. Nobody is judging you. The worst judge is yourself. And so to just love yourself and continue with your dreams, be active in class, you know, in dance class, do what you can outside of the studio and become a whole person. You know, don't just take dance class and go home and take more dance class and perform in that.
Yeah. Place, you know, and then get do some Pilates before bed.
Yeah. Get some other life experiences, you know, and I probably would have liked to have spent a little more time with my friends. In high school, I know a lot of my friends were always like, you never come out, you're always dancing. Yeah. And I was always dancing. So, but I did have a social life in high school, but I wish I would have done a little bit more. But to just continue to believe in yourself. And one thing I'm proud of myself for, though, is always persevering and not, you know, not giving up on dance, because like I said, my anxiety was the worst in the dance room. And there was many times where I would miss class and not go because I was having such bad anxiety. And I would just tell myself to continue to persevere and get to the dance class. And while you're in class, you know, do your breathing exercises and do your positive affirmations and do your meditation before you go into the studio. Because I do that now when I teach. You know, if I teach a class, I'll I'll do, instead of popping an Ativan, you know, I will like I used to, you know, and it was prescribed, but, you know, as needed.
Yes,
but
yes.
I will do some meditation. I'll do some positive self-talk. I would do some self-care exercises, you know, things like that. So I don't know if that answers your question, but definitely believing in yourself, and nobody is judging you. And if they are, then they shouldn't be.
And that's their problem.
That's their problem. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's their own insecurity manifesting itself. Yeah. It has nothing to do with you.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So then my next one, my last one is I'm going to give you my magic wand.
Okay.
You get to wave it one time. And you only get to change just one aspect of the dance world. What would it be?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think I would definitely say the whole body image issue. I know it's much more prevalent in ballet than modern, but I would love to see more full-size women and men being able to get big roles in big ballet companies and modern companies. I think that, you know, eating disorders, which go with mental health, are so prevalent in the ballet community. And also in the dance community in general, that I would love to see the eating disorder issue just be vanished. And I would love for women and men and people who don't identify as either or are you know, go by they, feel that they can move and they can dance. Because, you know, when I teach a class, sometimes I feel like people will say to me, well, I'm too fat, or I won't look good in a leotard, so I don't want to come to class. I'm like, anybody's a dancer. Anybody can move. Can you move? Yes. Yeah, so you're moving. So dance is moving with intent. You know, that's all it is. Yeah. It's just moving with intent. I actually had that as the first sentence in my artistic statement that I made years ago. I made an artistic statement and I said, dance is to move with intention. You know, when you intend to move a certain way, you're dancing, you know, but when you move, you're dancing, you know. And I think that comes back to my background in movement analysis, you know, is that Laban saw everybody as a mover, you know. And so I may look at things a little differently than maybe a different dancer that may say, well, no, not everybody is a dancer. And I get that too. I get that too. I just disagree.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. I love that. No, that's really great. Yeah, I agree with you that our dancing world would certainly be more beautiful and more creative and have even more amazing work.
Yeah.
You know,
and
like
more
how
representation
many people...
of the world. More representation of the world, of what human beings look like, you know, all over.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Like, what movement are we missing out on because some person can't work their way up in a company and can't get to be a choreographer or star in a role? Or what are we missing out on?
Right. What are we missing out on?
And you think it's good now?
Right.
Like,
right. If we allowed every single person who had a voice and who wanted to share allow them to share their art, you know, through dance. I mean, what a beautiful thing that would be. And there's, I feel like it's not fair. You know, it's yeah. not fair, especially people that genetically are predisposed to being heavier, you know. And I appreciate people who are heavier now that when I was heavier, you know, I never had a problem with being fat until I gained all that medication. I gained all that weight on that medication. And so uh-huh. it's like, I gained a huge appreciation for like just wanting to dance and not feel judged, you know, when I was dancing and, yeah. you know,
yeah.
so yeah.
Amazing. Oh, well, thank you so much. Before you go, please tell everybody where they can follow you on social media, the website.
Yeah. yeah.
And then any other information for your symposium coming up that people can get registered for?
Yeah. So I would say to follow our Instagram. That's what's most active. And it's at Erase Through Dance. We also have a website, which is erasethroughdance.org. But if anybody ever wants to reach out or has anything to say or wants to just talk with me or anything, my email is nina@erasethroughdance.org. I don't check that as often as I check it like once a day, but I don't check it as often as I'm on social media much more because I like to follow and see what's going on in the dance community. Yeah. So I'm on that at least, you know, 3 times a day.
yeah. And then the website,
yeah,
is where people can get registered for the symposium.
Yeah, we'll have registrations up. We're probably going to make it live streamed and it might even be free. I'm not sure yet. We have to kind of agree on that as a board. But all uh-huh. that information is up on our website right now under the symposium tab. And great. Then, yeah, so that's pretty much it.
Cool. And I will link all that stuff in the show notes for you guys so that you can just scroll through the show notes and click that link. And yeah.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you. This has been really wonderful. Again, fascinating story. I commend you for starting this organization and for actually doing something, you know, to start erasing the stigma. It's so important. And I'm really grateful for you and your organization. So thank you
so much.
All right. Have a good day.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.
Oh, what a great conversation with Nina. I am just really so grateful, I'll say it again, for her bravery and openness to share her story with everybody. And it's just really important that we get all sorts of mental health stories out into the dance world so that we can really connect with one another and use these stories as resources to continue to make the dance space healthier and happier for everybody. I just want to encourage you guys all that if you resonate with Nina's story today, to please click on the link in the show notes or the link in my bio on Instagram for all of the mental health resources that I have been compiling. I'm adding more and more as I get them, and I've recently added some international ones as well, not just in the United States and Canada. So please, 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 use those resources as you need them, and I hope that you all are well. Thank you so much for listening today. I hope you enjoyed the episode, and if you did, go ahead and leave me a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, follow the pod on Spotify, and share with just 3 friends to get the word out. If you have any questions, particular topics you'd like me to cover, or guests you'd like to hear from, please email those to me at dancebetterpodcast@gmail.com. And don't forget to follow the show on Instagram @dancebetterpodcast. Thank you so much for listening today, everyone. I cannot wait to learn with you on the next episode. Bye!